to VBAC Birth Stories, a podcast where Australians share their journey to a vaginal birth after cesarean.
We are a safe haven for women to share their own VBAC journeys and through these personal experiences, educate and empower listeners.
I'm your host, Mel.
And I'm your host, Steph. And this is VBAC Birth Stories. Hi everyone, today Mel and I are chatting with Sammy Griffin. She's a mum of two living in Queensland. She's a trained doula and former music teacher, and she's telling us about her first birth, which ended in an emergency cesarean. Sammy, just like one in every three Australian women, experienced significant birth trauma as a result of what happened. Her experience in her first birth went on to change the course of her life, inspiring her to help other women by providing emotional and physical birth support to those in need. We hear of her journey towards the VBAC, what tools she accessed to assist her towards her second birth, and what she did differently to ensure a more positive experience. Sammy teaches us that sometimes the most important tool is actually within us. It's our ability to listen to our own intuition and to trust our own bodies and their ability to birth our babies. Sammy, Mel and I would like to thank you very much for sharing your deeply personal birth stories, and we hope that you can all enjoy and take away a lot from this episode. Well, today, Mel and I, we're speaking with Sammy Griffin, who is a birth and postpartum doula. She's based in Brisbane. Hi, Sammy. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Sammy's going to tell us about her two birth stories, one of which was a VBAC about 4 months ago. Sammy, did you want to start by telling us just a little bit about yourself?
So I live in Brisbane with my husband, Micah, and my two children. Addie, who's 3.5, and Juno, who is 4 months old. So I'm a high school music teacher, but after I had Addie, I studied to be a birth and postpartum doula.
Do you want to tell us about before you fell pregnant? What sort of ideas did you have around birth, given you weren't a birth worker at that time? Before you fell pregnant with Addie, what were your preconceived ideas about childbirth?
The same as most people, I feel. Mainstream media, so quite negative. But my mum had this beautiful drug-free vaginal birth that she always talked to us about. So that was kind of what I thought would happen. And as well, my grandma had really good births too. So they were both saying to me, you know, you have your baby and then you're back at Craft the week after and you just, life carries on. So that was what I was thinking my birth was going to be like.
And when you fell pregnant with Addie, then how did that pregnancy go for you?
So that was a huge surprise, a happy surprise, but yeah, we definitely weren't expecting to get pregnant at that point of our lives. And I didn't know anything about care provider options or what birth actually looked like or, yeah, nothing. So I went into a random GP because I didn't have a GP of my own, and I got my blood test done. And then I went back to another one, random GP, to get my results. And it was 7 o'clock at night, and he was this older man, older gentleman, like pushing 75, could not have cared less about us being in that room. And it was very monotone, like, okay, you're pregnant. And we were in shock. Okay, what do I do? I said, do I have to stop eating anything? Or, like, what's the next step from here? And he fished around in this drawer. He's like, oh, I think I've got something. He just wanted to go home. And he got me this brochure from, like, it must be in the early 2000s about what foods to avoid in pregnancy. And so that's all the information I got. But it was a huge blessing I got him because he didn't try and do GP share care with me. He put me straight into one of the main hospitals in Brisbane, and I got straight into the MGP program, which I didn't know was a thing. I really, really liked the two midwives that I was given. I did hypnobirthing. My husband and I were really into meditation at the time, really dedicated to that practice and doing super like childless things, like going to meditation classes together on Thursday nights.
It which so is, luxurious.
Yeah, I know. It was. There's this beautiful monk at a Buddhist temple we used to go and sit and do a group meditation, which is, yeah, funny to think of doing that now. So a friend of mine who was pregnant at the same time said, have you heard of hypnobirthing? And I hadn't. And she sent me a couple of tracks and I just thought, yep, I totally get this. Like, I see how meditation helps me in my day-to-day life. I'm all in for hypnobirthing. My MGP experience prenatally I thought was excellent, but I didn't really do much research into what labor would actually look like or feel like. Or, you know, I hit my 40 weeks and I said to my midwife, okay, when do we book the induction? And she said, no, it's totally normal that you go over now. First time mums do go over, and you've got till 42 weeks until you're overdue. So she was very like with woman. She knew I wanted a hypnobirth. She was really trying to keep me on that path. But I was just so over it, and I was very, yeah, I was impatient. So I asked her to give me a stretch and sweep at 40 and 8. And I had not really done much research into it other than it could start my labor. So I didn't know any risks. All I knew was I'm so sick of being pregnant. And it worked. The stretch and sweep actually worked, which is pretty incredible. So, yeah, labor started in the afternoon and I was just beyond excited to go into labor. I rang my midwife and she said, great, eat some good food, rest, go to bed. And I did not take that on board at all. And I made my husband stay up all night with me through these contractions, which were like very early labor, like far apart, short. I should have gone to bed. But we stayed up and watched The Office all night and I was just too excited to go to sleep. And I rang my midwife, updating her on this early labor like every 2 hours. Yeah, I really, if she ever listens to this, I just want to apologize to you. And I've made a rule with my clients, like, you know, you don't need to update me throughout the night. I think I feel very bad about that. I'm doing that all night. It gets to 5 a.m. and just through pure exhaustion, I think, I ring her and I just said, I can't do this anymore. And I'm in tears and she says, that's what I want to hear. Let's go to the hospital. I must have learned it through the hypnobirthing course. My birth plan was only to have this undisturbed water birth. That was it. There was no other pathways. That was just like I had tunnel vision on that. And I must have heard from hypnobirthing that I didn't need vaginal exams, but I hadn't done any research into why that was the thing. So that the wheels fell off on that straight away. I like rocked into hospital and I jumped myself up on the bed and I was like, please, I need an exam right now. So she said to me, okay, you're 4 centimeters, we can admit you or you can go home and rest. And I said, no, I want to stay. And I really felt like if I was in hospital, I was going, my labor would progress more or something. Like I just needed to be with her. And, you know, it's true. Like if you walk through those hospital doors, your baby's coming out one way or another. So I jumped into the shower. I asked her to get the pool ready. And she was really stalling on that, but she didn't say that. She just, yep, sure, I'll get the pool ready. But I know now she wouldn't have wanted me to get in so early at 4 centimeters. So the pool took a long time to get ready. I enjoyed the shower. I was having a great time in there with my husband. I had only had hypnobirthing tracks on my iPod or whatever I bought in at 2018. And I hadn't thought about if hypnobirthing didn't work, would I want other music or anything? So then my husband started curating this playlist of like Bon Jovi and The Boss and like this really strange labor music, but I was so into it. I was like singing and hypnobirthing's gone. It is out the window. I should mention, I used the TENS machine all night and that worked really well. I really enjoyed the TENS machine. So I was in the shower and it must have been about four hours. I had a student midwife as well who was great and she was in the shower with us. I just remember looking down at her shoes getting saturated, these leather shoes, and she was really good. 4 hours has passed and I have another vaginal exam and I'm 7 centimetres and I'm devastated because I had no idea how labour progressed and I thought, why aren't I pushing? I've been doing this all night. When actually, like when I look back, that's awesome. Like if only I had known what I know now, I could have eased into it a bit more and gone with it, but I just couldn't. So I hopped into the pool and it was just awesome. I loved, loved, loved being in the pool. And then I started to get quite pushy. My contractions were now on top of each other. And my midwife, I want to just say how great she was, because she never said to me, don't push. She said, go with your body. If that's what you're feeling, just go with it. And I begged her for another vaginal exam. I think she said, it's only been 2 hours. I don't want to give you one. Just go with it. Just trust your body. And I couldn't. I had zero connection with my intuition. I needed her to tell me what to do. And so anyway, she got my husband to lift my hips up in the pool and do another exam. Okay, you're still 7 centimeters, which is fine. Like, yeah, that's great. That's fine. You can have a bit of a stall there. But I was just, I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. What's the next thing? I need help. So she said, you want to try the gas? So yes, I tried the gas for a while. Didn't really help. So I was saying, need help. I need help. Help me. I was really playing like the victim. Come on, give me something. So she got me, I was actually probably begging for an epidural at this point, but she knew my birth plan. And so she said, why don't we try morphine? So I had the shot of morphine and she said, you have to get out of the pool though. So I'm on the birth ball, so drugged out of my brain. Yeah, it was horrible. Like I would never do that again, the morphine. I was dozing in between contractions. I was so out of it. My head was really foggy, but then the full pain of the contraction was still there and they're on top of each other. And obviously now looking back, he was posterior, you know, the pushing at the 7 centimeters and the contractions on top of each other. But I didn't even know about baby's positions then. And she was getting me to be active. So maybe she had an idea, but she didn't voice that to me. So anyway, I'm begging for an epidural at this point. And someone comes in and he places the epidural and it works perfectly. Amazing first time, full block. And I just said, I'm going to name my child after you. You are incredible. It was the best. And I didn't realize how lucky I was, because now most of the epidurals I've seen as a doula have not worked first time. And people have had partial breakthrough pain or worked on half of their body or whatever. So, yeah, I was very, very lucky. He was good at his job. So my midwife said to me, you know, it's time to rest because you're going to push out this baby. So she must have known he was posterior because she got a peanut ball. And for the next 4 hours, her and the student midwife rocked my hips to try and get him in a better position. Around 6:30, his heart rate must have started to go up and I have spiked a fever at this point. And so an obstetrician came in and she said, look, baby's not really coping very well. We can let you labor for the next 3 hours. But if we do that and then you have a cesarean, you could bleed out on the table. And that's my first trauma point for that birth, because, yeah, it made things very real for me that this could end up quite bad. So I didn't want to do that. I didn't feel like bleeding out on a table. I said, well, wheel me in. Why are we waiting? That's ridiculous. So then she reads through the risks of cesarean. And at this point, I just lose it. Like, I just can't deal with here. I thought I was going to die at that point. So that's a big trauma point for me. So they wheel me in for the cesarean. And on paper, yeah, it was perfect, perfect cesarean. But, yeah, just I guess I hadn't expected it to, yeah, go that way.
Yeah,
I had actually skipped the cesarean parts of all the books. Like I read Juju Sunjin's Birth Skills and I think she's got a chapter on cesareans, and I was like, I'm not gonna need that, skip.
When you think about every other surgery that people go into hospital for, usually this is something very planned. It's spoken about, you know, all of the risks and benefits are weighed up well before that point.
Exactly.
But with something like particularly emergency cesareans, yeah, you're at such an emotional point by that stage, and it can be quite scary when you're asked to consider all of that information.
Exactly. And when a doctor is there telling you, you could bleed out on the table, it's very overwhelming. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yep. So it was a bit of an out-of-body experience. Like, I just remember saying things that I thought I should say, like looking at this little baby, like, oh, I love you so much, or I can't remember what I said, or like, welcome to the world, little one, or something. But I was just so dissociated from what was actually happening, and I didn't feel that. So I had him on my chest, and I just said to my husband, you got to take him. And my husband did skin to skin in theatre, so that was lovely. But yeah, I just couldn't even hold him. I did in recovery have our first breastfeed, which was good, and the midwife was really good to help me latch him on. And yeah,
was his heart rate showing any distress at any point?
Yeah, so they said it was high, but he was fine. That was just one comment from the obstetrician. It wasn't like they were from in the room. It didn't seem like they were watching it for hours or anything.
How did you find the hospital care sort of post recovery and on the ward and all of that?
Yeah, that was, you know, fine. There was midwives there to help me. I remember when the obstetrician came and did the birth debrief, she couldn't understand why I was so sad. And I was crying, and she was just like, oh, but everything went really well, and you've got this healthy baby, and you're good. And she could not understand why I had, the baby blues hit me very, very hard. And I think she came on maybe day two or three, and yeah, she saw a very, very sad person.
Did you feel the birth in any way affected your bond with Addie?
Yeah, I feel, look, it's hard. There was just so much going on. So, yes, I would say by the time I hit the 12-week mark, I was totally in love with this little baby. It was hard because he had reflux as well. So, yeah, the bonding was hard when Bub's crying all the time.
After you had that debrief, did that give you any resolve about the trajectory of your labour and all of that? Did you look back on it and say, oh, okay, I can see at this was a turning point? Or
he said to me that baby was never going to come through your pelvis, and that's kind of all she said. I didn't have an idea. Did that mean that my pelvis was too small, or was he in a bad position? That's the information she gave me. Mm. Yeah.
They were able to comment about his position being posterior after the birth?
So, nobody ever told me that until I had started studying doula and I studied to be a spinning babies parent instructor. Did I realize, oh my gosh, this kid could have, like, there are things that you can do to help this. But yeah, he came out with the big cone head and he was really stuck in there, malpositioned.
So you said you had your first breastfeed there in recovery.
Yep.
How did it go from there? How did you feel mentally, and how did your breastfeeding journey sort of evolve from that point there?
Yep. So he had tongue and lip ties, which weren't picked up for 5 months. So we struggled through for 5 months with like nipple shields and low supply and all the things that come with tongue ties. Reflux, he cried for the first 12 weeks of his life. And that was really hard. But after I found a good IBCLC who picked it up, we were able to tackle that. And he's still breastfeeding now, 3.5 years later. So, yeah, you know, you can overcome those things if you can find the right support.
How did they get rid of the tie? Was it like a laser in the end that had to, or what?
No.
Happened?
So she actually just showed me how to reposition him. And I decided not to get his ties cut. That's not everyone's journey. I just felt like at 5 months, it may have been a bit too traumatic for him. So, yeah, and then breastfeeding went really well after we did those few positional changes.
How are you feeling about the birth, say, 5 months down? Was it on your mind at all? How did you process?
Oh, yeah. So I had some pretty serious postpartum anxiety and I had to get help for that. So I went to the maternal health clinic for breastfeeding support. And she just said to me, how was your birth? And I just broke down. And she said, okay, we have counselors here if you would like to talk to someone. And so I rang them, and I think this was maybe 2 weeks post-birth, and I said, I need to talk to someone. And so this was in early March, and she said, okay, yeah, we've got someone on the 19th of April. And I just went, do you mean the 19th of March? And she said, no, the 19th of April. We don't have anything for 6 weeks. And I just thought, I'm not going to survive the next 6 weeks if I don't have someone to talk to. And even like the major hotlines that you ring, even they had delays. So it was, and this is how I got into being a doula, because I just thought there's got to be somebody who comes in and helps people, because I had so much support for my family and my friends, but I still felt like that wasn't enough. Like I felt like I needed someone who works in that space all the time, who gets it. And so I started researching and found there were doulas who come in postnatally and help. And I just thought, I've got to do that. Like, this is ridiculous. Also, I had been reflecting on, as teaching in high school, I had a fair few students who had had babies themselves. And I work with mostly refugee and asylum-seeking students. So English is often their fourth or fifth language, and their teens, some of them don't have family here. And I knew when I had heard their stories before I was pregnant that it was not right. Some of them had to like catch a train in to give birth and then catch the train home with their newborn to an empty apartment. And I knew that wasn't right, but until I'd had my baby, I didn't have, I guess, the level of empathy to go, we are failing society's most vulnerable here. Yeah, every new mum needs that support. I felt very sad for the students that I had worked with who I didn't really realise what they had been through, I guess. Yeah. So that led me to studying to become a doula, because, my postpartum period was very dark and, quite a hard time.
Did you find that you were able to find someone who really understood that and empathised with that eventually?
The counsellor was really good when I eventually got into her. I got put into a mother's group with the maternal health clinic, and that was probably my saving grace. Those women, I was just very lucky to get into a group who, we're all very much on the same page and going through similar struggles, and it was, good support.
Did they talk about VBAC before you were discharged?
My midwife did. She came in, the first thing she said was, don't worry, you can have a VBAC next time. And I just looked at her like, you crazy woman, as if I'm ever doing that.
So did you feel like you had this aversion to sort of going through birth again because of your first experience?
Yeah. I was like, that was terrible. Yeah. So we didn't know if we were going to have another baby, or like I definitely was just going to book in for my repeat cesarean, because that was just, labor was awful, I thought.
Wow. Yeah, definitely identify with that. So then following the birth, that was, I suppose, the catalyst, and going through the PND for you was sort of that catalyst to wanting to help other women through this process and going through to study to become a doula and give postpartum support. So what happened on your journey from there, and did you want to talk about what you learned through your training?
Through my doula training, I just realized our maternity system is in absolute crisis, and it's not even our most vulnerable, it's even the affluent women who are struggling. The ones who can afford the private obstetricians are getting mistreated. So it was a big journey.
So when you did that, this is prior to your falling pregnant with Juno, prior to that, did you change your mind during that process?
Oh, big time. So then I kind of just put my feelers out there, anyone need a doula, and I ended up with all these women who were going for VBACs, because the universe just gives you what you need, I guess.
It was true.
And actually, one of them has been on your podcast before. She had a birth before arrival, Jess, in one of your very early episodes.
Yeah, Jess, that's right.
Yeah, when I was still a student doula, I supported Jess. And then not even VBACs, but all these first-time moms, second-time moms, third-time moms, having these physiological, beautiful births. And my trust in birth was just fully restored because I could see you can do it. It is a natural function of the body. And my one of the mentors that I had said, well, what are you going to do next time? Are you going to have a VBAC? And I said, oh, I don't know if I'm allowed to. And she just went, what do you mean if you're allowed to? And I said, well, I don't know what happened. I haven't seen my hospital notes. Like, what kind of scar do I have? I don't know any of this. She goes, Sammy, you can have a VBAC. You don't need anyone to tell you you can't have a VBAC. And just that moment, I was like, like a bit of clarity, like, of course I can. Yeah. When I support a woman who's having a VBAC or a first-time mum who wants a physiological birth, I have no doubt in my mind that she can do it. Like, or otherwise I wouldn't take them on as a client. I'm just all in 100% and I just have full faith that they can do it. I tried to be like that for myself. It's harder with yourself though. Yeah. And then I also did see some things working as a doula where I could kind of pinpoint where things went off the rails due to hospital policy, I guess. So I was very aware of, I don't want to misspeak, but of just how women can be mistreated in hospitals, I guess. Mm. You're a number. Get them in, get them out.
So do you want to take us to falling pregnant, I guess, with Juno, and what was your plan in your mind for this birth?
Okay, so I was all in for VBAC, of course. So I just didn't want to fight anyone. I didn't want to have to fight anyone in my labor. I wanted only supportive people in that room. So I got a private midwife and I interviewed a few private midwives before I settled on Jess, who she was new to a company that is in Brisbane and I hadn't worked with her before. And just from the first meeting that we had, I knew that she was the person I wanted in that room.
And did you meet Jess prior to falling pregnant? Like, is this sort of like planned, I guess, ahead of time?
No, I hadn't. When I was in my early pregnancy, I didn't know what I was going to do, whether I was going to try for MGP again, home birth, free birth. Like, hospital birth, I didn't really know what I wanted to do there. Yeah, so I had a couple of questions that I wanted to ask the midwives. In the interview process, I asked them what was their experience with uterine rupture and or VBAC, because I didn't want someone who had a trauma with uterine rupture. I didn't want anyone to be hypervigilant in that room. I just wanted the right amount of vigilance, just the normal amount. And her answer was so good. She was just like, Well, I saw one when I was a student midwife, but we just took her for a cesarean and she was fine and the baby was fine. And it was very nonchalant. I also wanted to know what their thoughts on free birth were, because I felt like you had to fully trust birth to empathize and understand why women would free birth. And she said, I totally get why women do that. Yeah. And she had no, it wasn't like, that's very dangerous, women shouldn't do that. It was, yeah. Like, so I felt like she fully trusted birth. Also, I want to acknowledge that having a private midwife is a huge privilege that not everyone in Australia can afford. And, you know, continuity of care, 8% of women get into an MGP in Australia when we do actually have the funds, but it just shows the lack of respect that hospitals and our governments have for women. So, yeah, that comes from a great place of privilege to be able to afford that type of care. And I wish that every woman had the opportunity to have that continuity of care.
Absolutely.
I'm sure many women listening to your podcast know how hard it is to get into an MGP. It's not easy. So MGP was really good, but really you get just a 15-minute with your MGP midwife if she's there, if she's not at a birth. But with my private midwife, if I was at a birth, I had to cancel for a couple of births, or if she was at a birth, she had to cancel a couple of times. So we'd always rearrange. So we'd always meet with each other and they would go for 40 minutes to an hour, these very in-depth appointments. And I just remember when we did the birth debrief for Maddie's birth and she just looked at me, just like in the eye, held my hand and just said, I'm so sorry that happened to you. And it just was the most validating. Like, I just felt so good that someone understood. And she said, like, obviously he's posterior and, like, you know, there are things that you can do for that. And, yeah, she just, yeah, she was very understanding.
Did you feel like when you were pregnant with Juno that you were still unpacking and processing the emotional side of that first birth and,
big time,
the trauma that you had? Yeah.
Yeah, because I had put it on a shelf because I didn't want to ever bring that into a birth room with other women. And I didn't talk about my birth with other women unless they specifically asked for details. But I was very conscious of, you know, this is their births. And I think I really put it on a shelf for 3 years because it wasn't the place or the time to look at that birth.
I think there's a little bit of a stigma as well about sharing, particularly with women who are first-time mums. There's this idea that other women who have been there, that you're not meant to share your birth experience if it wasn't positive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That you just shush up about it. But really, yeah, there's a lot to be learnt from those situations.
Definitely. If they're in a place to hear those stories.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And they can find them in places like this and learn.
At what stage did you feel that you had reached that, I suppose, acceptance of your first birth and kind of started healing that?
Oh, maybe after my VBAC. Every session with Jess, I saw her maybe every 2 weeks or something. I just cried and I just thought, oh my gosh, you have so much like built up emotion around this birth. Still, things that I hadn't realized because I had put it on a shelf. So I didn't realize that I still had all this trauma that I needed to work through. But I did things like lots of birth art. So Pam England has Birthing From Within, that book, and in there you do lots of birth art. And so I would be drawing how I felt in my first birth and what this birth was going to look like. So I think those kind of activities, I guess you call them, helped me to process that birth.
Were you planning a home birth this time with the private midwife?
Okay, so I was trying not to hold on to any idea of where I was going to birth because I didn't really know where I wanted to birth. So I had all my things set up for a home birth, but the ultimate plan was to go into the birth center at this particular hospital and birth there. But I didn't know what I was going to do. If people asked me, are you having a home birth or a hospital birth, I'd say, I don't know. Or even like, are you having a cesarean or a VBAC? I don't know. I didn't want to put any energy into, I don't know, thinking about that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's
a weird way to process
there
it.
There was also a sort of, I guess, that underlying fear that if you have an expectation of something and then it doesn't work out, that then you would feel re-traumatized again. Or
exactly. I didn't want to fail again, I guess. Yeah.
So you're sort of protecting yourself in that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a lot of that. Mm. I've shut down every conversation about it. And if people didn't know I had had a cesarean prior, I didn't talk about it. I didn't. And those who did know I had a cesarean, if they said to me, what are you going to do? I would just say, I don't know. I'm going to decide on the day. When in actual fact, I was definitely trying for a VBAC, but I didn't want anyone to know that.
So you were, you did have everything set up in case it did happen at home, or if you wanted to labour at home, you have a birth pool there.
Yep.
But the plan is, I guess, eventually to go to the birth centre at your local hospital. That's great that your private midwife was able to support you in that hospital environment too.
Yeah. So she had just been accredited because she was new to this company as well, to the hospital. So that's good because then she didn't count as my one support person. Because if she hadn't got those accessing rights and we were in a hard lockdown, I would have had to choose between midwife or husband as a support person. But because she had that, she was just like a hospital staff, essentially.
So in this pregnancy, what things did you do differently? Did you do anything differently in terms of birth preparation that you didn't maybe consider in the first time around?
My last birth was when I was 36 weeks pregnant, and I was still working in schools until I was 36 weeks pregnant as well. So I kind of felt like I wasn't doing much preparation. But when I reflect on it, I was doing a fair bit just in between, just not as dedicated to, say, the hypnobirthing tracks that I was doing in my first pregnancy. I did the Jane Hardwick Collins Healing from Traumatic Birth e-course, and it was so good. So she gave lots of journal prompts, unpacking things like your first period, your first sexual experience, your own birth from your mother, your grandmother. Yeah, so that put a lot of things into perspective for me about why I feel certain ways about birth or even how you birth. It's all connected, your red thread. So learning about that. And I read 10 Moons from Jane. And I don't know if you've talked about that book much on here, but she's a VBAC mum herself. So she was a midwife first, had the cesarean, then had the home birth VBAC. So that book was awesome. In that was lots of fear release prompts and journal prompts. So yeah, that was great. I essentially needed to connect to my intuition to be in complete control and take full responsibility for my baby and my body in this pregnancy. Whereas my first birth, I would, or my first pregnancy, I'd ask my midwife, what position is my baby in? This time I didn't want to give that power to anyone else. I prepared as if I was having a free birth. Even with my midwife, I said to her, if I birth unassisted, I want to know baby resus. I want to know postpartum hemorrhage. I want to be in complete control if I do go down that path of any emergencies. I kind of felt like I needed to aim further than a VBAC at hospital, if you know what I mean. I needed to, yeah, aim further than that to achieve that.
Just have all of the contingencies covered in that space.
Yeah.
If we go down this path, we do this or this happens. When you were speaking about fear releases there, or from what I can remember doing, is sort of where you write down all of your fears about your VBAC or birth or anything really. What was one of your greatest fears with your VBAC?
You know, my main fear was the hospital staff, to be honest, and having to interact with staff members that I didn't know who could derail the VBAC, essentially. It wasn't uterine rupture. It wasn't losing baby or anything. It was. I had a real fear of these hospital staff, especially, yeah, after my experience with the obstetrician in my own birth. Actually, something I didn't say about Adi's birth, because I had spiked the fever, she recommended antibiotics after he was born. And my husband and I said, no, we would prefer not to do that. My midwife had said it's a really common side effect of the epidural, like you don't have an infection, essentially. I said to the obstetrician, I don't want to do the antibiotics. And my husband said, we're really worried about his microbiome, giving him antibiotics straight after birth. And the obstetrician said, he's not going to have a microbiome if he's dead. So that kind of attitude and just the very deadpan way she said it.
Sort of this worst case scenario language that was used and clearly had a poor effect on you.
Exactly.
At the time and following that. So that was one of your fears going into the VBAC was being presented.
After I had written out all my fears, I looked at it and I was like, oh, my goodness, you were scared of the hospital staff rather than birth. I felt like my baby was healthy and that she would be okay.
Did you want to take us now to the end of your pregnancy with her?
Yep. Oh, and on the contingency plans that you talked about, yeah. I did the birth mapping care providers course with Catherine Bell, who I know you've had on the podcast, and she's just amazing. So I had this epic birth map. Like, it was ridiculous. It was on this huge sheet of paper and I brought it into my midwife and it had everything from the unassisted birth to a cesarean in a coma. And then I had a breastfeeding plan for if I was in a coma for however long. Like, it was intense.
Wow.
Yeah. I love listening to Catherine speak. She is awesome.
She's fantastic. Yeah.
That book is a non-negotiable for me. Yeah. I also did chiro and osteo as well through my pregnancy, which I found very, very helpful. If I was going to recommend any resource to women, it would be the heavyweight champion, I think, of birth books, which is Birth with Confidence by Rhea Dempsey. I reread that just before I went into labor, in the 2 days before I went into labor. I love it. I think that every woman I've ever given that book to has had a really positive birth.
Yeah, we definitely hear a lot of women mention it.
I read that in my first feedback as well. That's yeah. It stayed with me. Like I remembered points that she made into the second birth as well. It was just like this confidence and trust in, you know, your body. Birth with Confidence, yeah. Essentially. It really is a great book. You know how you mentioned, you know, you sort of kept it quiet, your desires yep. to VBAC. What about close family and friends?
Yeah, I didn't talk about it. It wasn't up for discussion. My mum was in the room when the obstetrician said he was never going to come through your pelvis. And I think she made one comment to me like, well, why don't you just book another cesarean? I was in there. I heard what that obstetrician said. And that was the only kind of comment she made about it. She's very supportive of my decisions. But, yeah, so I shut it down. I didn't talk about it with anyone except for really my doula, and not even with my close friends. I didn't bring it up. Yeah, doula, midwife and husband, that was it. That was my bubble.
Uterine rupture, you mentioned before, you weren't so worried about that. You were more worried about the hospital staff you mentioned. So, so no real concerns that on your mind. You had, like, I guess with your birth map, you would have probably put that as a...
as one of the pathways. I should have focused on it a bit more in my fear releases, though. It really did come up for me in my transition. But, yeah, during my pregnancy, it wasn't even... You know, if I support a mum who's having a VBAC, I never think that she's going to have a uterine rupture. And I know it does happen, but...
Did you have any pain or niggles in your scar at all? Any sensations in your scar?
Nope. I only had round ligament pain and, yeah, just a couple of forward-leaning inversions and that would go away. So, yeah, I honestly didn't think about my scar.
What was the main difference between your preparation for your VBAC and your first birth?
Yeah, I think it was taking full responsibility this time for everything to do with my baby and my body. And that's why I love Jess, the midwife, because she would say, would you like me to check baby's position? And then she would say, before she said anything or before she checked, she said, what position is baby in today? And she put that responsibility back on me, which I really love that. She would ask me, do you want me to check with a doctor? Being able to be the expert in my baby and my body was very empowering. Highly recommend it.
Do you want to take us to the birth now, or yes. labor, as you're yep. approaching the end stages of your pregnancy? Were you worried at all about position at this point?
I
remember.
I think we were messaging each other, Mel.
And yeah, posterior.
We were both like, oh, we've got a posterior baby. I knew where she was at every minute of the day. I was so connected with her. And I did a belly massage every night, listening to Jane Hardwick Collins' Shamanic Drum Journey, like this very intense nightly ritual. And another thing is I really worried about Addie, my son's movements all the time. I had so much anxiety about it. And in Juno's pregnancy, I had none of that because I just felt like I was connected to her at all times. And that is about connecting to my intuition, I felt, for me personally. I had a 36-week appointment with an obstetrician, just very routine through this midwife company that I went through. And my midwife came with me to that. And I had a couple of things on my hit list that I wanted to talk to him or her about. And we walk into the room, and it's this very young obstetrician. And he looked and he said, okay, you've had a cesarean. What's your plan? And I said, I'm having a VBAC. And he said, great. And he went to sign off the thing. And my midwife went, oh, hang on. She's got a few things she wants to talk to you about. So I said, I don't want a cannula on arrival. I don't want CTG. I want to have water. And I don't want to talk to anyone from this hospital at all during my birth. I don't want to sign anything when I walk in. I just want to only see my midwives. He said, okay. I'm just going to get my boss. And so he walked out and in comes this older obstetrician, this man, and he brought out this form. And on it, I had to say all the things that I was going against medical advice for and my reasoning for those things. Yeah, so the cannula was easy because, you know, according to the 2020 Queensland clinical guidelines for VBAC, that's not something you have to do. And I told him, you can drive a truck through my veins. We do not need to do a cannula on arrival. The monitoring, he said, that's really something that you need to have in case you have a rupture. And I said, look, I've listened to so many women's stories who have had ruptures, and it's a similar thread in most of the stories that those women knew something was wrong before it showed up on the CTG. And I said to him, they're not evidence-based anyway. If I'm in that room and I feel like I'm having a rupture, I need you to listen to me and to wheel me into that theatre. I don't want you to look at the screen and go, no, nothing's wrong. I want you to listen to me. Yeah. And so he happily signed that one off. Water, well, that's part of the clinical guidelines as well. You can have a water birth now. And he just bought all the forms out that I would need when I rocked up to hospital for me to sign on that day. So, yeah.
What was the main reasoning for you not to have the CTG monitoring and the cannula? Did it go back to that first birth at all?
I just know how uncomfortable cannulas are, and I can see when women are labouring with a cannula how, you know, they say it doesn't hurt. That is not true. They really hurt.
Even if it doesn't hurt you, it can restrict your movement in many ways. And restrict the movement of your body, which is important when you need to be having active labour and moving into different positions, whether or not you can get into water then. So you had signed off on all that before labour, and this is sort of something.
Also, the act of going into a hospital during labour is going against the physiology of those birthing hormones, leaving your safety of home. And so then having to lay on a bed and get monitored or have a needle put into your arm, again, that's going to add hours onto your labor because you're disrupting the natural process of your hormones. So I didn't want any, if I had to go into hospital, I didn't want to do any of that stuff.
I wanted to know, did you secretly want to home birth? Like, did that kind of play on your mind a bit?
Yeah, in my mind, in my pregnancy, I wanted to free birth. I wanted to not have anyone, not my doula. Actually, we had very in-depth conversations about this. She isn't comfortable supporting free births. Like, she supports women to have them. She just doesn't feel comfortable to be the doula in a free birth. And so that was fine. So my visualization was me on my own or just with my husband free birthing. But when labor started, I just called in those women. That went out the window. I really, really wanted, I had made deep connections with Jess and Kirby, and I wanted them with me. And if that meant I had to go to hospital, that's fine. I wanted to be surrounded by those women.
That's awesome. So how did it all start, your labor?
Okay. So I don't know. You might want, you can take this bit out if you want to. On the Wednesday before my due date, I had sex with my husband, and I woke up that evening to a trickling of water, and I just thought, oh god damn it, I did not want my waters to break before labor had started.
Were you having sex at all to try and naturally induce labor?
No, this was a pure act of love, because I because I didn't want to do anything to induce labor. I was like, get clary sage away from me. If I had a client who used clary sage, I'd get them to have it on a tissue, not diffused in the room. I didn't want acupuncture. I did all that stuff in my first pregnancy. I did like acupuncture. I was eating curries, pineapple. If I read something on the internet that said it was going to put me in labor, I would do it. This time I didn't want anything. I went to get a massage. One of my clients had actually bought me got me a massage voucher for a induction massage. And I went in there and I said, I don't want that. Don't use clary sage. Don't do any acupressure points. I just want to relax. And that was just before my waters broke, I think, like maybe the day before that. Yeah, so I was avoiding, because I really trusted that my body was going to do this on its own. I didn't need a natural induction method, which is still a form of intervention. So I didn't want any of that. So anyway, after our love, I woke up, my waters were trickling, and I just was like, god damn it. I hadn't even bought pads. I actually had this bag that I was collecting for vulnerable women who had had babies, and in there was a packet of pads, so I got one of those out.
And how many weeks were you at this point? Sorry to interrupt.
So, 39 and one. And I just put the pad on, went back to bed, ignored it. I hadn't even been through my birth map yet with Kirby, my doula, because we had to keep cancelling because women kept going into labour for both of us. So I messaged her that morning and I said, we need to get a coffee and have some brunch because we got to go through my birth map today. So we did that. And I said to her, I'm not telling my midwife. And she is a very good doula. She didn't say anything. She just said, okay, I totally trust you, your judgment on that. The next night I'm laying in bed again and waters are trickling. They're just trickling kind of continually but very slowly. And so I'm just keeping my fluids up, connecting with my intuition, connecting with my baby. She's fine. She's safe. So that's, yeah, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, still nothing, still just a trickle. I'm not mentioning anything to my midwife. In fact, she had gone to a wedding. Oh, this is how secret I was keeping my pregnancy. I told everyone in the world besides my husband that my due date was 2 weeks after my due date because I didn't want any pressure about, did you do that as well, Steph? I didn't want any pressure, people ringing me or anything. Yeah, so I said to my midwife, and I believed I was going to go 2 weeks over. So she told me she was going to this wedding weeks ago near my due date. And I said, it's fine. I'll still be pregnant then. It's fine. So I knew she wasn't even in the office then. So I really didn't want to ring anyone because I know that if your waters are leaking, it can lead to different types of intervention, possible induction. And you know what? This is my personal judgment. And I would never, this is totally going against medical advice here. Like I would never recommend this for anyone.
And that's something that people would have to weigh up is the risk of a medical provider knowing that and then your risk of induction or antibiotics or what's greater or risking an infection to your baby. And I weighed up the risks and benefits of both every day. And I felt like I was safe to continue for that day. And I just took it day by day.
I wanted to know what kind of color your, this is the birth nerd coming out, the waters, was it clear? Was it pinky like in color when it was leaking? Steph's laughing.
Yeah. It was clear and sometimes pinky, but it was like not urine. Like I knew it was the waters. Yeah.
So it gets to Sunday. My waters are still trickling and I think, okay, this is it now. Like, something's got to happen. It's been days and days now. And I connected with Juno and I did my belly massage. I did my shamanic drum journey. And I said to her, you can come now. Jess is going to be back on shift in the morning. It's safe. You can come now. And that night at 12:30, I woke up to my first tightenings and I just knew, like it was so mild, but I just knew this was it. So I just chucked my TENS machine on and went back to sleep as much as I could. And I'd wake up through a contraction, press the boost button and then go back to sleep. And I dozed and slept. I had a really good sleep actually until 5:30 a.m. And then I couldn't ignore that anymore. So I got up and had a shower. It was actually my husband's grandmother's funeral that day. And it was 2 hours west from where we are. And I thought, he could probably go and do that. It was so mild what was happening. But then my son woke up and had a breastfeed and then things kind of kicked off a bit after that. So I said to my husband, I'm really sorry, but you're not going to be able to go to your grandmother's funeral. You're going to have to stay just because it was so far away. And I messaged Kirby, my doula, and said, look, I know you got a couple of shoots on because she's also a photographer. Go and do those. That's fine. Like I'm going to be here all day. But then as soon as my son had that breastfeed, I messaged her and said, actually, I need you here. So at this point, and I wanted Jess there as well, like I was counting down the minutes until she came back off her little holiday. Yeah, so my free birthing idea was gone within the first crisis of confidence that hit. Yeah, I wanted those women with me. So I was in the shower having hip squeezes. Kirby comes. She's halfway in the shower with me in her beautiful clothes. Jess, my midwife, came around 9:30 that morning. She must have felt my tummy. I can't remember. This bit's a bit fuzzy. And she didn't say anything, but she just said, okay, we need to do some forward-leaning inversions and sideline releases. She's into spinning babies as well. So she's trained in optimal fetal positioning, I think. And that was pure hell, honestly, like being upside down during contractions. And it was payback for all the women I've ever made to do spinning babies in their labors It was so awful. But it's sometimes what you need to do to get the job done. Walking up and down my stairs sideways and, yeah, doing everything to get baby into a better position.
Did she mention what kind of position she suspected Juno was in, or?
She didn't, but I knew Juno was posterior. So maybe, I can't remember if she palpated my stomach or if I just said to her, this baby's posterior, I need to do something here. And also shaking the apple trees for hours. And
that's like the rebozo, is that what you
mean?
Yeah. Did you get any back pain? Like, was that an indication as well that baby's posterior, or was it just an intuition?
Oh yeah, I could feel exactly where she was. I knew where her back was and where she was kicking. Yeah, she was ROP for most of my labor, so yeah, along my right side there.
So you're doing spinning babies maneuvers while contracting, while in labor. Take us from there.
Pure hell. So then Jess left us. I think she was there for about 2 hours and then she left. Kirby and my husband were working so well as a team to do hip squeezes and just get me through the contractions. I was actually also doing my own internal exams when I felt called to do that. So I knew that I was still in quite early labor. So Ree Dempsey talks about these things called the crisis of confidence. And it's when your endorphins and your oxytocin are kind of rising through your labor, but then your endorphins keep rising, your oxytocin stalls for whatever reason. And it's normal. It's a really normal part of labor. But at that point, you just feel like you can't go on and it's just too hard. And how am I going to get through this? And you just have to give yourself, say, 4 or 5 contractions until your oxytocin then meets your endorphins again. And then you can just cope with this next level of pain. So I could feel every crisis of confidence. There's one at like 1 to 2 centimeters, 4 to 5 centimeters, 4 to 6, then 7, 8, and 10. And I hit all of them really, really hard. And I just had these breakdowns continually whenever I hit them. And then I was doing these internal exams, so I knew they were right on cue. I had this beautiful moment on my son's bed with Kirby, and she just said, what's going on? Something is blocking you. What's happening for you right now? And I had this full emotional outpouring, you know, this block that needed to be moved, just this grief of the relationship I have with my son and how that was changing now. And it will never be the same again after this day. And that was the exact thing that I needed to do. I know Ina May Gaskin talks about that a lot. If there's a block or if there's a stall in your labor, it's often an emotional block. And that was, yeah, very true for what was happening. Yeah, so that was beautiful. I really appreciated that moment with Kirby. And my hot water ran out in our house. I had the birth pool ready to go and no hot water to fill it up. So I just said, it's fine. I'll just get in my little bathtub. And I know how annoying they are to fill up with pots on the stove. And so I was just like, no, I need you guys with me. I can't have someone doing that. Just let's do the bath. So I was in my little bath. And my contractions through most of my labor were about 40 seconds long and say 5 minutes apart. So it looked like really early labor, but I knew that it wasn't. I knew that I was progressing well. But, yeah, it didn't look like active labor. So I rang my midwife again and she came back down and we did more spinning babies things because Juno just wasn't shifting from that right side, which is annoying because she was in an OA position like the week before I went into labor. She was just ready to go and then she shifted there the night before I went into labor, I guess. I did 7 contractions in a forward-leaning inversion. And that was just more than any woman should ever have to do in their labor. That was so full on. But after I came back up and I got really pushy and I said to Jess, this baby is not coming. Like, I'm not pushing her out. I'm 7 centimeters. She's posterior. That's why I'm pushing. And Jess said, do you want me to check? Would you like me to see what's going on? And we had discussed it in depth that I didn't want any internal exams. But actually at that point, I was like, yeah, I do want you to come and confirm that for me. So she checked. She didn't say anything about how far along I was or baby's position. She just said, what do you feel? Like, how would you feel about getting in the car? And I had no hot water. I was kind of a bit done with the environment I was in, actually. And I was like, okay. And I knew that peak hour traffic was going to start soon. So I was like, yeah, okay, I'll do that. My doula was actually just out getting Mexican at this point. So she comes back and we're all hopping in the car. She was probably like, what the hell happened when I was gone? and hop into the car. I'm munching on my chippies and we get to the highway and I had my eyes closed and I had my TENS machine on and my eyes closed. My husband goes, do not open your eyes. And I did. And it was just bumper to bumper, stopped traffic. And so in the car seat, I had propped myself up on pillows so my knees were below my hips to try and get her into this better position, OA position. And also I want to say there's nothing wrong with a posterior baby. Lots of posterior babies come out fine. I've seen some really effective labors with posterior babies. I just felt like I didn't have the space in my own pelvis to birth a baby in that posterior position. And I don't know if that's true or not, but that's just how I felt. So I had my TENS machine on and my TENS machine tells me the length of the contraction and the rest in between. And I just looked down at it because I thought, oh, that's a big rest. And it was only a 40-second rest and my contractions now had gone to 1.5 to 2 minutes long. So I'm, you know, having my transition in the car. And my wonderful husband and doula kept taking these wrong turns because we had to go through this tunnel in Brisbane that has no GPS signal. I was in the car for about 1.5 hours, I think, labouring.
Oh,
I don't recommend it. However, it stops you from getting an epidural if that's not your plan. So finally get to the hospital.
I love how you're always looking at the positives.
Yeah. We finally get to the hospital and my husband pulls into the taxi rank and my midwife's there with a wheelchair and I'm vocalizing and I have James Shamanic Drum Journey in my headphones and it's just this like very intense experience that's happening. And I jump onto the wheelchair on my knees, so I'm holding onto the handles like facing her, so I'm backwards on the wheelchair. And everyone in this like close proximity knows that I am in labor. Like my midwife is yelling, can you feel a head? And I'm no, there's no head. So my husband gets his Mexican and starts following us and a taxi driver just goes, oi, what are you doing? Can't leave your car there. And he says, that's my wife. And it's just like this Hollywood moment. The security guard goes, go, go, go. And he's like sending him through. And
with his Mexican in hand.
Yeah, he's carrying his little bag of Mexican. It's so funny. And I said to him, when did you eat that? He's like, I gobbled it up like on the way in. So, yeah, it was, funny. So we get into this assessment room and true to the hospital's word, I didn't see anyone from the hospital, didn't have to sign a thing. I just get into this assessment room. And one thing my midwife had said when she did the internal was that bag of waters is just bulging. And when that releases, this baby will be here any minute. So I had this moment in the assessment room and it's just me and the two private midwives that I know. And I just think to myself, on the next contraction, I'm going to break this bag of waters. And I don't know that, I don't think that's a thing. Yeah. But anyway, I did. And it was, again, in this full Hollywood style, this gush, and it goes all over my poor midwife's shoes. I'm really sorry, Jess. And it splashes up on these tiles onto everyone in the room. It's just like a lot of amniotic fluid. It felt really good. And then we go straight into this birth suite, and it was magical, honestly, like dark. This big birth pool is there ready to go. It didn't have to be filled up. It was hot water there for me. I had this beautiful music on and I remembered at this moment because I thought, oh, actually, I have to tell you, I had this real crisis of confidence getting wheeled into the hospital and I've got my head on my midwife's shoulder and I just said, I can't do it. It's not happening. And she just said, you were going to do it. This is happening. And I just go, you don't know. And I'm screaming that to her. And she's like, I do know. You're fine. We're going to have this baby today, like now. So I just loved having her there. She was just so reassuring all the time. So I walk straight into this pool of water and it's bliss. so good. Then the fetal ejects reflex comes on and I tried a few pushes in the water and something didn't feel quite right about that. So then I would rest in the water and I'd stand up to push the baby out. Yeah, I didn't actually realize, but I actually had CTG on me at this point. And I don't know, that must have been put on in the assessment room. I didn't even notice it until the second midwife said, "Sammy, we can't get baby. I'm going to need you to get out of the pool." At that point, realized that I had monitors on. And I was like, whoa, no, take the monitors off, get your Doppler out. I'll sign whatever you need. So she went out and talked to the obstetricians that were probably dying to get into my room and bought me the thing. And in between contractions, I just signed it. And then they started using the Doppler. So yeah, I didn't even remember getting it put on and I didn't even notice them on, to be honest. So then I'm standing up and pushing and I just feel like
something's not right. Like I feel like she's not descending how she should be. And I just start to get this little bit of urgency within me, like something's just not right. And I did my VE at this point on myself and I could feel her. She was so close. And I couldn't get out of my doula brain either because I remember voicing to my midwife and doula, "You're going to have head-on view in the next contraction." Like I couldn't get out of that kind of, that headspace. Then I start to get this pain in my scar. Mm. And so I had been feeling the ring of fire, but then what was taking over that was this burning pain in my scar. I was trying not to say anything to anyone, but apparently I was just rubbing my scar, rubbing it. And I had to, in between those contractions, concentrate. Is that pain going away? Because it was so intense. Mm. And I think, yeah, I think it's going away. And then with the next contraction, all I can feel is scar pain. And I'm thinking now, oh my God, like what is happening? And my heart rate, I could feel my heart rate was really rising.
Were you panicking a little about uterine rupture at that point? Did you vocalize it to anyone or just it was just a sort of like, I need to wait and see?
It was definitely a wait and see.
Is the pain consistent and through the contractions? One of the signs of rupture is that there is no break, isn't there, that you get that intense pain even without a contraction.
I was trying to focus on that and I thought, yeah, okay, I think it's going away, but then kind of, you know, everything's on top of each other and so it was getting quite intense. I kind of felt something tear, and with that contraction was a big gush of blood that my doula silently alerted my midwife to. And she just tapped her and pointed into the pool and there was this fresh blood in there. And the second midwife, Michelle, who's actually a VBAC mum herself, she just said, "Sammy, I think it's time for you to get out of the pool." And I wasn't using the pool to push anyway. And I was really happy with that. And there was this really cool moment, actually. I get out of the pool. So our midwife had left a mirror on the floor. And as I stepped out of the pool, there was like this ping pong size in between contractions view of my baby's head, and it was this full black hair, and I'll never forget that. It was just so cool to see that. But so I get out of the pool and I just go straight to the bed and I just go on my back on the bed, and I had this little thought, and I just thought, they need to get her out so they can fix me, because now I have thought I have ruptured. So my midwife said, can you give us a push on the bed with your next contraction? And I do that. And the second midwife said, "Sammy, there's this tight band around your vagina that is just not giving away, like it's blanching." And she said, "I would think at this point, if we give you a small episiotomy, your baby will come out really quickly." And I had talked to my midwife about episiotomies in depth in our prenatal appointments, and I knew the full risks and benefits of this intervention. And at this point, I am panicking now and thinking, we need to get this baby out. And I looked at Michelle and I just said, "I need you to give me the smallest episiotomy you've ever given anyone." She said, "Yes, I can do this." So an obstetrician walked into the room and just observed, didn't say anything to me or the midwives. And she did. She gave me the smallest episiotomy and my baby came out on the next contraction. And I just want to pause on that moment because it is That was the single best moment of my life. Pulling my baby out onto my chest was just indescribable. The oxytocin high was just better than anything in the whole wide world. It was so good. Yeah, I did it. I remember I was shaking. I had so much adrenaline and I was just like crying. I did it. I did it. I know my doula's got this video on her page of me the moment after I've had Juno, and I'm just so ecstatic, and yeah, it was just the best. But
I've seen that footage, it's beautiful.
It's a it just has that moment of euphoria that you just watch it and you just feel the euphoria in the video for you. It's
an unbelievable feeling, and it's wild feeling a baby leaving your body. But I am bleeding a lot at this point, and I know I can feel I'm bleeding a lot. And so my midwife said I would recommend the shot at this point, and I agreed, and I felt like I'm hemorrhaging here, like I need help here. And again, that is a intervention that I had talked to her in great depth about. We talked about all the different scenarios where I would accept it and when I wouldn't, and a wait and see approach, and I didn't want to do that. I felt like I wanted that shot then. The placenta birthed really easily, like 10 minutes. There was not even much of the belly massage. It just kind of came away very quickly, but the bleeding didn't stop. So then I did get the cannula that I didn't want and some more Syntocin, and I believe put through that to try and control the bleeding. So I had a second degree tear on my left side and the episiotomy on my right side. The reason why I felt like she wasn't coming out and the gush of blood and everything, she had two nuchal hands up near her face. So she ripped my cervix actually as well, we found out, because she forced her way through, and the midwife just said, I cannot believe you birth a baby with two hands like that. Yeah, two little fists up near her face. And I've seen one nuchal hand come out, and I definitely reflect back and think the episiotomy, that was a welcomed intervention, and if that's what I needed to do to push out this baby with her hands up, then that's fine. And that would be the reason why there was that gush of blood, I believe. And the feeling like my scar was ripping was probably, the midwife said, her just sitting at my cervix there in line with the scar, trying to push through with the hands.
So it wasn't actually, your scar wasn't actually rupturing. It was just the sensation of her position that was affecting and making you feeling that fist. Way. That's so cute though. I can imagine like just this, coming.
I know. Everyone kept
actually
going,
really cute.
Oh my gosh, she came out like this. Like it was this cute thing. I was like,
but not
I
cute
am. There's things going on now.
So how was that following the birth for you in terms of recovery down there after the episiotomy?
So what happened was I continued to bleed, and we took a wait and see approach for 7 hours before I consented to going into theatre to have a Bakri balloon put in to stop that bleeding. So they estimated I lost 1.6 litres of blood. And I actually asked them to stitch me in theatre with the spinal rather than doing it in the room. Recovery-wise, so much better than the cesarean, but still needed a lot of rest. I think I was out having coffee with a friend at 10 days postpartum, sitting on a blanket, like in a bit of pain still. But recovery-wise, 9 days, like so much better.
Yeah.
And mentally, so much better.
Yeah, I was going to say, obviously, mentally, did you feel that you didn't experience the baby blues this time as intensely?
I didn't experience them at all. I was on cloud 9 for like the first 10 weeks until we went into a lockdown and then it all came undone. But I could not have been happier. Yeah, it was the best postpartum period ever.
That's great.
I did a lot of postpartum planning in my pregnancy as if I was going to have a repeat cesarean, because I needed to come to a place where I was okay with having a repeat cesarean. And for me, that looked like having the support postnatally. So I hired a postnatal doula, Nat, who is phenomenal. My husband had 5 weeks off work. I didn't cook for 3 months. I had meal trains and frozen meals for 3 months. So that all helped in that recovery process.
That's really good. I wanted to ask you, in terms of, you know, the physical recovery, what would you say that tear down there with the episiotomy would have been equivalent to? Would it be like a third degree, or would it be like second? Like, what would it be equivalent to?
It is so small. So my osteo, who I saw prenatally, I've seen postnatally, she just went, that is the smallest episiotomy I've ever seen. That midwife actually got in trouble from the obstetrician because she said it wasn't big enough. When it was, the baby came out. Yeah, she debriefed me and said, yeah, I got in trouble with that episiotomy. I can't even really feel it. Like, it must have been a nick. Recovery-wise, I'd never felt the episiotomy. I only felt pain from the tear. Yeah, and the scar, I can barely feel it, where I can feel the tear scar. Yeah, so I'm doing work to like scar mobilization, just as you would with a cesarean scar, to try and like help the healing process with that.
Sammy, I wanted to ask you, how did breastfeeding go this time around with Juno?
So she also had a tongue tie, and I have an amazing IBCLC that I refer women to, and they all have great success with her. And so I got her to come down. I told her I was pregnant. Watch out, I'll be giving you a call. And so she came down and we just did a couple of position things. And yeah, I think my supply's really good this time because my son's also breastfeeding. So she, even if she was just living off the letdown, she's thriving. She's doing well. But yeah, there was maybe pain for a week before I got the position right and the latch right. Yeah, a dream, like night and day. She doesn't have that reflux and, you know, the other issues that come with the tongue tie. She's doing well.
How is tandem feeding going?
Awful.
Are you trying to wean your older one, or are you just going to press on?
So I can't feed them at the same time because I have to be so careful with her positioning. My son, not anymore. That's fine now.
I hate doing it. So I'll breastfeed them both separately. And my son only has like a minute in the morning and a minute at night. He's not really breastfeeding very often. But yeah, I don't know. I probably wouldn't recommend it. It's okay. It's hard. Mel, you did tandem feed, right?
I did. I think it's one of those things that it's good. I did with my first and my second, not with Amelia, partly because of those reasons, but it has its benefits. But it's also just depends on what you're willing to kind of, I guess, put up with. It takes a lot out of you and you can feel really touched out. I think once you finish the journey, you can look back with fondness.
Yeah, it's a lot, isn't it? It's fine separately. It's just doing it at the same time is, I can't do it.
In terms of like your first birth and where you're sort of feeling about it now, what kind of, I don't know, I think Jane Hardwick-Collins, she talks about learnings, I think, a lot from your first birth. What does your first birth teach you? Mm. And since you've been, you know, you've read her books and things like that, what would you like to, I guess, touch on that point?
You
reflect on your first birth now that you've had a VBAC, for example.
Yep. I 100% believe you get the births that you need. But in saying that, there is a lot of coercion and bullying and things that are happening, mistreatment that are happening in hospitals. So it's not that part of it. But if we were all supported properly, we would all have the births that we need for our certain parenting journeys or to be the best mothers that we are, I guess. And I would never have gone down the pathway of being a doula, something that I love, really lights me up, if I hadn't have had that experience. Yeah. And the inner work that I did to take that full responsibility, I wouldn't have done that as well if I hadn't had Addie's birth. So it's important. And I think that chapter is definitely closed for me now, and I feel fine. I feel good about his birth. And I feel, and the path it led me on, and obviously I feel very, very good about Juno's birth. I'm very proud. And the VBAC journey is so full on, isn't it? It is, you know, you can get pushed back on so many things, and it's already hard enough to just have a baby. But then when you're not supported by your care provider as well, it's a really hard journey, and one that I don't know people can empathize with unless they have been on it themselves.
If you had to give, I suppose, women out there listening a piece of advice for their journeys, of what would that be?
I think, well, one would be only have people in your space that are fully supportive of your journey. And like I said before, it's a privilege to be able to afford a private midwife or to get into an MGP. But, you know, if you get to 40 weeks and you're in a public hospital and they say, for whatever reason, no, we can't support you on that anymore, it's their duty of care to refer you on to a hospital that can support you. So don't just take that and give up and just go, oh, well, they said I had to do this now. If that's what you really want, if you really want to be back and there's, you know, you can't see a reason why you can't have that besides maybe what this hospital policy is, you can. And I know, like, traveling, sometimes you're rural and, or sometimes you've paid all this money to an obstetrician and they do the old bait and switch at 38 weeks and you can think, I'm going to lose out on thousands here. You know, there's always options. In most cases, there's mostly options. I think the main thing that I learned was to not give away your power for seemingly small things in your pregnancy, such as the position of baby. Become, if you can and if you feel called to do it, become the expert in your body and your baby. Because if you start to give away your power for, let's do the example of baby's position, and you rely on your midwife or your obstetrician to give you that information, you are being conditioned then to, when you're in your labor and the big stuff comes up, you're going to submit. And because you're conditioned now to be giving away those seemingly small things. So when the big things come up, it's harder to take that responsibility for those things.
Yeah.
So if you can and if you feel called to do it, you know, listen to your intuition and get in touch with your body and your baby, because no one cares about your birth more than you. And also just get so deep into Jane's work. Like, she's just amazing. Follow her Instagram and, like, just become, you know, this wild witch woman.
manifest yes. You'll be back.
Massive thank you. And I think one of those things that you've touched on as well is intuition. I think that really comes across in your story. I think that's a really good point. And I think that's something that we often doubt because we've been conditioned to doubt that in our own lives. As you know, growing up, we're never really told, what does your intuition say?
Yes,
we never asked, right? Actually, we never really asked that. We're always told, well, this is the risk, these are the benefits, this and this and this and that. But no one ever says, well, it's very rare to find someone who says, but what does your gut tell you?
And we give it away so easily in pregnancy, because that is in no other situation. Like, say you were having your appendix was rupturing. You're not, you know, you fully give your power to these doctors because they are the expert in that. But pregnancy, it's not, you know, it's not something that is wrong with your body. It's a natural process of your body. So, and, you know, I see on the VBAC Australia page all the time, women, they recommend a late term ultrasound, or they recommend gestational diabetes tests, but I don't feel like I really want to do that. And, you know, these are the little things that we give away and we feel like, oh, you know, something doesn't sit right with me about that, but we still do it. And yeah, so then we can easily submit in labor to bigger things sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a slippery slope.
Yes.
Thank you for the work that you do supporting women and acknowledging that access to these sorts of resources, it's not always equal. Thank you for the work that you do in that space. If you'd like to find Sammy, she's at Sammy Griffin Birth Support on Instagram. Otherwise, that's www.sammygriffinbirthsupport.com. She is based in the beautiful Sunshine State. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
And thank you for the work that you ladies do. It is just, I listen to every episode. It is a community service. It is.
That's so nice to hear.
And you know what? I also recommend you to first-time mums. I think it's really important for first-time mums to learn from women, and women who go on the VBAC journey are often very, very educated in. They try and really unpack what happened, what went wrong, and how did I end up on this pathway? And yeah, I think it's important for everyone to listen to these stories.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also, we were first-time mums too, right? All of us.
That's right.
We've been there.
Exactly.
But yeah, thank you so much, Sammy.
Thank you for listening to this VBAC story. If you like the show, please subscribe and feel free to leave a review. If you would like to connect with us on social media, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for VBAC Birth Stories. If you have a question or you'd like to express interest in sharing your personal story, email us at vbacbirthstories@gmail.com. VBAC Birth Stories is a podcast where we share women's lived experiences. Please be advised that it's not intended to replace medical advice. If you have any concerns at all during your pregnancy, please always speak to your healthcare provider.